everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal, and it's February 2019, and you're listening to episode 111. And this episode is about Ernest Hemingway. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Mitchell. Stephen teaches English at Covenant Day School in North Carolina, and he has a PhD in humanities from Faulkner University. Stephen has written a literary apologetics article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Humanity Crucified, Hemingway and the Human Condition, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. Stephen, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Melanie. It's good to be here.
Well, I'd like you to explain for our listeners who Ernest Hemingway was. He was a 20th century writer, but why don't you tell us a little bit more about him?
Sure. So Ernest Hemingway probably could be thought of as one of the anchor authors of American modernist literature, born right as the century was turning over in 1899. He stands as a kind of quintessential 20th century American writer, especially up through the middle of the 20th century. He did win the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1954, so there was worldwide recognition of his work. He was something of a, I guess he was a journalist as well as a fiction writer. He was, I guess we could call him politically active in that in one way or another, he took part in several wars on something of a volunteer basis, as an ambulance driver and then also as a reporter. But he did so because he believed in the struggle of this, you know, one of the sides. He wrote a number of really important American novels. He may be best known just through high school American literature courses for The Old Man and the Sea, which is a little novella about, and we'll talk about it later, about a character, Santiago, who catches and loses the biggest fish of his life all in one short fishing trip. He wrote The Sun Also Rises, which looks at some characters post-war. He wrote Farewell to Arms. He wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls. And all of these were especially good, I think, at capturing a strange hopelessness that is turned sort of back around to justify action and effort in this world. That's a bit of who he was. He was adventurous, liked to go on safaris, known for all of that. And he did, unfortunately, and there's a long history apparently in his family of depression. He struggled with it. He did end up committing suicide, shot himself in the head when he was in his early 60s. So that is Ernest Hemingway.
I think some of our writers might wonder, why do we cover literary apologetics in the Christian Research Journal? And why are we talking about maybe some older writers that have classic works? And how does that apply to apologetics? And one thing is, really, the arts is just a great way. Some of these writers and filmmakers and things that we talk about on the podcast, just a really great way to think about the human condition and then be able to speak into that as Christians. And so whether you have a film night and discuss some of these topics or that we cover, or you have like a book club where you could get together with non-Christians, friends in your neighborhood, people from church, and discuss some of these things, we feel like it's very valuable to use the arts as an apologetic tool. And Hemingway, certainly I would encourage everyone to find out a little bit more about him if you don't know about him, because he knew a lot of famous writers at the time. And his life was almost like a novel. So what makes Ernest Hemingway compelling as a writer himself?
Yeah, as you suggested yourself, and what I always think is the first and best reason for reading anybody, and that is just that his works are good, and by that I mean they're artistically good, they're well crafted, and there is something just pleasing about reading a well crafted work, but they're compelling because they're true, and I mean something particular by that, because I don't, of course, share Hemingway's what I understand to be his worldview, but they're true, and this is, I think, what we have to ask of writers. They are true to the world as that writer is able to see it, and inevitably, whether they work from assumptions that are accurate or not, by living in this world, by observing it, by trying to portray it truthfully, by having that as a desire, they are going to be accurate. But you know, maybe they're not going to get the full picture at times, or see everything that we may wish that they would see. But his work is exciting. It's it's compelling because it tries to ask honestly that if there really is nothing, if we can't be sure that that there is a an afterlife, and if we don't have complete power over this life, then how are we going to live? And Hemingway tackles that, and he does so, I think, with a measure of honesty that that draws me to him. I think would draw others to him. So that idea of truth telling as an ideal. Even though with any writer, of course, there's going to be a limit to their vision. We are all, limited in our perspective. But even if you come away from him thinking, no, I don't quite think that's the way life is. You have stood with him and seen the world as he sees it. And there's an openness and honesty in that which I admire, which I long for, and I think others will as well, because that's the kind of person that you can have a conversation with, provided we also, right, are willing to be honest about the world we are in, and to speak as truthfully as possible of the world as we see it and know it. And of course, if we are Christians, as our faith shows it to us. So for those reasons, I find him compelling as a writer. He is often exciting. For Whom the Bell Tolls is a good thriller. You often get a deep sense of struggle. He is excellent at depicting romance, and he is superb at depicting humans who endure tremendous loss and yet somehow, perhaps even because of that loss, have a elemental dignity that is just really beautiful and really poignant. So dark as his work tends to be, it is really lovely in that same dark, with that dark thread running through it.
I just talked a little bit about why we consider a literary apologetics a worthwhile endeavor to feature in our journal, but specifically for Hemingway, for the Christian apologist, What do you think that's compelling about his work that would be of interest to Christian apologists?
Yeah. Sure. And this will relate a bit to even just what makes him compelling as a writer, but Hemingway was very, very, very conscious, I think, that he was writing in a post-Christian world. And that may not have meant that at the time the run-of-the-mill American didn't identify as a Christian, but that Christic assumptions about the nature of existence had, at least amongst artists and intellectuals, more or less passed by, or the bulk of them had. Obviously, we've talked about writers, even on this podcast, for whom that was not true. That retained their faith, but Hemingway was himself, I think, deeply suspicious of what religion could offer. But he faced squarely, I think, the implications of that for the world, and so I think for people interested in apologetics, it is always helpful to be able to talk clearly about what the options are if indeed the claims of our faith are not true. So to see clearly sort of what the other possibilities are, what the other options are, are they compelling? Do they actually account for all of human desires and human existence as we know it? So here's an example. So we'll talk about this again in several of the other novels, but Hemingway really does seem to present a world in which death is it. And so if that's the case, then what do we do with the fact, as Lewis seemed to be convinced of, and I think he was right, that we have this deep desire for something beyond death. And so the fact that Hemingway paints a world in which those deep desires are fundamentally frustrated, I think opens a space to talk about those desires. Are they irrational? Are they absurd? Or can we maybe take them as an indication of something that lies beyond this realm, which Hemingway and those like him were able to see? So, is indeed nihilism, and I'm not specifically speaking of the Nietzschean kind, but the sense of that ultimately there will be nothing, is that triumphant? Or is there a place into this very tragedy that Hemingway wants to delineate, this tragedy of human existence? Is there a space opened up right there for the Christian gospel to speak sort of at that moment, right? It was Auden, I think, who says in his book-length poem, For the Time Being, and he's really responding to this very sort of problem, that he says, nothing can save us that is possible. We who must die demand a miracle. And he's speaking of the resurrection in that poem. And so one of the things that Hemingway's work does is it, at the very least, helps you understand, it throws into stark relief the hope that the resurrection offers, because it doesn't sugarcoat what existence, the dark final defeat, if you would, of all humanity and all of humanity's aspirations and hopes if there is no resurrection. So it makes the choice pretty stark. Again, he's not making arguments because he's telling stories. He's not, making a philosophical argument, but he is telling stories from a philosophical position for sure. And I think, telling stories that are true to that philosophical position, and that therefore allow the Christian apologist to focus the hope, the good news of the gospel, to the very human problem that it is, or one of the very human problems that it is intended to overcome, and that is the horrifying finality of death. And so that is one reason I find him of interest to apologists or to people interested in apologetics.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Stephen Mitchell. Stephen wrote a literary apologetics article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Humanity Crucified, Hemingway and the Human Condition, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. Stephen has a forthcoming literary apologetics article coming up on the work of author Cormac McCarthy, who has written some well-known novels like Blood Meridian, No Country for Old Men, and The Road, some of which have been made into films. And so to read this upcoming article on the work of Cormac McCarthy, please subscribe to the journal. A subscription is $33.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. Well, I want to talk specifically about your article, and in your title, Humanity Crucified. In your article, you're suggesting that crucifixion is a theme in his work, and I'd like to ask you why that is, and also, is there a relationship between this theme of crucifixion and his kind of almost, you know, hyper-masculine in the traditional sense, when I use that word, for which he was well known?
Yes. So machismo is often used as a descriptor of Hemingway's, his personal swagger, if you would, and certainly it marks, there's a very kind of rugged masculinity that marks many of his characters. And in Hemingway, we see this, you know, he's hard drinking, he's a big game hunter, he likes to go on safaris and quests, he of course participates in wars, considerable affection for things like bullfights and boxing matches, and just these sort of stereotypical hyper-masculine endeavors. On the other hand, you know, everyone really in his novels is defeated. Every one of those super masculine characters. And there's a really fine essay by Kathleen Verduin, a scholar that has had some influence on how I see this. There's often some Christ figure in his novels, but it's a little bit puzzling. For example, Santiago, most people read Old Man in the Sea and they see him as a Christ figure, and it's impossible to miss it. You know, his hands get bloodied in the palms. There's even a reference to a cry he makes when the sharks eat his fish that is like those that someone might make when a nail pierces his hand. There are these cross images that show up, but Hemingway always denied that Santiago was a Christ figure. And it may be that we can understand this sort of backwards. And what I mean by that is that for Hemingway, Christ wasn't really something special other than as a picture of the end of all humanity. Every human being is ultimately condemned to death, and every human being is, for better or worse, forsaken by God, forsaken because it's not clear to Hemingway that there is such a being, or that if there is, he has anything to do with humans. And every human being is subject to the final collapse and the final defeat of whatever he strives for. Again, because existence is delimited by death. And Christ is for him an especially potent image there because he endures it without recanting what he lived for. So it's very, very specifically, it is the crucified man, not the resurrected man, that is Hemingway's picture. So you've got that one side, crucifixion without resurrection. And so rather than seeing Santiago as a figure for Christ or as a Christ figure, this may be a nuanced detail, but it seems to be that that Christ is sort of in an odd way, he's an everyman, a common man. And insofar as men are willing to strive and endure in the face of a guaranteed defeat of their endeavors. So humanity is crucified in that sense, that death awaits everyone, and that everything you strive to achieve will collapse. You are alone, and machismo then becomes it becomes that willingness to endure. It's not necessarily an ability to win so much as it is a willingness to fight for what you value, what you think is right, what you think is good, knowing that there's no ultimate hope for its success. You might even call it a kind of modified stoicism. And I say modified in that most of the Stoics, believed there was a divine overseer, a divine rationality to the world. So they worked to accept the world as it was. And so this is modified because on the one hand, you face the reality of the world, that you will die and everything you love and cherish will also die. On the other hand, the machismo stance is that you strive nonetheless. And there's a short drama in his short story work called Today is Friday, which is just the depiction of his crucifixion through the eyes of the soldiers, who are these weird connoisseurs of human suffering. It makes sense. They're accustomed to crucifying people. And so it seems that they have this habit of coming back and discussing the way the man dies. And they say repeatedly of Christ, he was pretty good out there today, or he was pretty good in there today. Like, they're impressed with how he dies. And for Hemingway, that is kind of the pinnacle of human heroism. It is also tragic because it is fundamentally futile. There's a real thematic connection, I think, between him and another contemporary of his in this way, Albert Camus, whom we've written about as well. But that's where the crucifixion and the machismo, I think, come together.
I'd like to talk about one of his best-known short stories, which is called A Clean, Well-Lighted Place, and you open your article with a quote from that story. And if people aren't familiar with that story, it's got a very stark setting. It's in a cafe, and there's only a few main characters. There's an old man that is part of it. Seems like a theme for him, older men. But also, you know, if anyone has not read the story, it ends, there's towards the end, there's this, what would be for Christians, a very profane rendering, kind of like a parody of the Lord's Prayer. So I'd like to ask you about that particular story and what it has to do with, for example, the nothingness towards which, you know, Hemingway struggled with, probably feared, and towards which you just mentioned that human beings were moving towards that.
Yeah, the profane rendering goes something like, "Our nada, who art in nada, nada be thy name." So it's, you know, thy kingdom nada, thy will be nada. And nada is a a Latinate version of nothing. Nothing. So yeah, the it is one of my favorite short stories of his. I think there's something in it that is resonant, even if you believe in a resurrection, because there is, there just is a measure of loneliness in everyone's experience, and A Clean, Well-Lighted Place picks up on that, but then presses it out to a kind of absolute and ultimate, its ultimate implications. You know, are we ultimately, fundamentally alone in this world? And there's a young waiter who is serving a very old man at the cafe, and then there's kind of in between the two an older waiter. And the young waiter is frustrated because the old man is sitting there drinking till late into the night, really maybe into the wee hours of the morning, and he won't leave. I don't know how they did their cafes over in, I believe the setting is France. Obviously here we'd just be told to go home. they'd close the place, but he won't leave. So this young waiter who has a woman at home that he's passionately in love with, that he wants to get home to, very understandable. And so he's frustrated with this old man who just staying and sitting. And the older waiter is where you really get the kind of the philosophical reflection on, because he understands the tension between the old man and the young waiter. And he knows that essentially that old man is just trying to remain in a place where light and human presence and even physical structure, the building itself, can for a while longer hold out the darkness toward which he would be going that night, going back to an apartment by himself with nobody to greet him, you know, to sleep in a dark room alone, but being an old man, also aware that this isn't just what I face tonight, but this is what I face fundamentally, and it's coming sooner than I would like. The young man, by contrast, he's young, he's vigorous, he's, you know, his romantic and sexual desire is strong, and he has every anticipation of fulfilling that in the evening if he can just get back to his apartment where his lover is, his mistress, his girlfriend. He doesn't feel his existential solitude. He doesn't know it yet. And the older waiter, he gets it. You know, he's lost love. He's aging. And so The Clean, Well-Lighted Place becomes, I think, Hemingway's image for everything that humans do to give structure, permanence, light, and meaning to our existence. It is surrounded by darkness, as the cafe is, the cafe that the man sits in is surrounded by the darkness of the night. And it lights, it, you know, it's there for a while. You remain in it as long as you can, but of course, you're going to be ejected eventually. So human striving, whatever it is that we build, whatever sort of attempts to build a meaningful world, whether that is political, whether that is romantic, whether that is artistic, it's like this cafe that sits here casting on itself this bright light. We dwell within that light as long as we can, but that light itself is engulfed in and surrounded by a darkness that it really can't fundamentally and finally overcome. So we like to live in these clean, well-lighted places. We like to hide. I think there's a sense that at least when we're young, we like to hide from the implications of meaninglessness that is that awaits us in death, if indeed death is the final collapse of everything that, you know, that we strive for, because it is the final collapse of us, because there's nothing after it. And so he captures the blindness of sort of the early days of life, when we aren't yet as emotionally aware of how futile, in Hemingway's view, life is, and the poignancy of holding on to what humans make, to the human world, if you would, that might come upon a man or a woman as they age, as the reality that their light, if you would, is soon to be snuffed out. And, you know, by the nothing that presumably is always waiting to encroach upon our existence, our human being. And so the clean, well-lighted place, just very gently, I think, shows that sadness, and the hope, the hopelessness, it's there. And so, it's one reason I like it.
You were talking earlier in this podcast about his, really famous work, The Old Man, the Sea, the novella, and probably just to refresh everybody's memories, because it's probably been years since, middle school English class, the main character, Santiago, is a fisherman. And so what does that particular character, Santiago, have to do with Hemingway's view of meaninglessness in this world?
Yeah, it's funny when you think about reading Old Man in the Sea in middle school or even high school, because that's an older human's book, really.
Yeah, I don't know when you're in, I think I read it in seventh or eighth grade. I don't know if I really had the life experience to understand some of the themes.
Yeah, I mean, you can deal with the prose, but the sensibilities of that work really, require some experience in the world. So it's stark. Hemingway had attempted to have this stripped down, apparently simple style that he liked to use. And Old Man in the Sea certainly has that quality. But it's also true to the story, because Santiago, the character, really, I mean, there's a few side characters, but it's pretty much just him through the whole story, is himself a kind of stripped down character. He's a Cuban subsistence fisherman, very old, very poor. He eats if he catches sufficient fish in a day to have food, and lives in a little shack. He is elemental. And yet he is one of these, there's just some really beautiful phrases that Hemingway uses for him. One of them is that he says, "I'm willing to know what I have against me." Santiago, as a fisherman out on the sea, has lived a demanding life, I would say. He knows that the world is not put together just to sort of serve his hopes and his dreams. He has struggled his whole life, but he has always accepted, lived into, if you would, that struggle. And he has not stopped doing that. There's another line in the novella that runs basically that he wants to demonstrate what a man can do and what a man endures. So this idea of struggle and endurance, and that is crucial to Santiago. Now, he is not, again, his machismo, if you say it's there, it's not in battlefield heroics. It's not in, erotic escapades. It's not in facing a bull or, as a matador. It's not these grand things. He's just a poor fisherman. But he goes out to sea by himself as an old man to see what he can catch. And it turns out on this particular day that he hooks the largest blue marlin of his life. And it's immense. It's like 1,500 pounds. It's just huge. And thus begins, and I think not accidentally, a three-day struggle with this fish. I had indicated that, you know, there is these Christic elements about Santiago, and I think the three-day struggle is part of it, kind of an echo of the 3 days in the grave of the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. So he's out there for 3 days. He's struggling to hold this marlin, and the thing pulls him just all over the ocean, way out to sea. And basically, all he can do is wear it out. It's too big to bring into his boat. But he's not going to let it go. And the fishing lines ends up cutting his hands, and he suffers a good deal. But he finally, after 3 days of battle, he wears that fish out, draws it up to the boat, fastens it on, and finally heads back to shore. And just as that happens, of course, the sharks come and they attack his fish. And by the time he gets back to shore, there's nothing but a skeleton left. So Santiago has this sort of paradoxical moment, right? He has caught the biggest fish of his life, well, really probably the biggest of anyone around there. He's done it. And yet, he's also lost the biggest fish of his life. He's lost all of that effort in that the sharks have torn it, you know, they've left nothing but its skeleton. And all he has to show for all of his efforts, right, is this skeleton, this leftover. And so there again, if he is a Christ, I've suggested at different times that he's a futile Christ. In that, there is no triumph other than the struggle in which you are guaranteed to be defeated. So you struggle against it. You go fishing anyway, you lash it, you bring that skeleton back to shore, and then he goes to bed, basically, and you know what he's going to do is get up and do it again the next day. Probably won't hook a 1,500-pound marlin the next day, but he's going to get up the next day and fish again. But the story is rendered so poignantly, and you see the dignity of Santiago. This is one of the wonderful things that Hemingway can do. Like he sees human beings trying to establish some sort of meaning, some sort of wholeness to their existence, trying to achieve something, not just in terms of career or records. Santiago isn't vainly ambitious, but that catch signifies our larger and deeper human attempts to have lives of meaning. And the struggle is incredibly poignant. For Hemingway, it's incredibly important, but it also is ultimately futile. We will be defeated by this world. And so The Old Man and the Sea again highlights that dimension of human experience, and then for me as a reader, I say this precisely, right, is why the Christian hope of the resurrection speaks to me, because again it speaks to this promise of a triumph over that very defeat, which for Hemingway is the final defeat. And so it remains, I think, one of my favorites for that reason.
I'd like you to briefly touch on his works that deal with war. And you mentioned that he was a journalist. So at the time, you know, what we would consider an embedded journalist now, he was there on the battlefield dealing with war, seeing it. And he recounts, you know, war in The Sun Also Rises. You mentioned Farewell to Arms and For Whom the Bell Tolls, which I think I read in high school as well. Why was he interested in this really dark part of the human experience? I mean, he just basically saw all the darkness out there on the battlefield.
Yeah, and I think that is very much part of the reason, is that he lived through two world wars, right, and a number of various kinds of political revolutions. You know, you saw the Spanish Civil War, which is where For Whom the Bell Tolls is set. He was present for them. He saw them as important human struggles. I want to be careful here. I don't know that though he saw the war itself as a struggle to make the world a better place, but he saw somehow within that humans striving against a violence and destructiveness that that was trying to overwhelm them. And you see various responses to the destructive power of war, its finality, its ability to collapse our dreams, not even just at death, though obviously war kills a lot of people, but even for those who live past the war. So if in, the Clean, Well-Lighted Place, and if in Old Man in the Sea, the real fear is the death which awaits a man at the end of his life, right, after living a long life. In these others, we see that that collapse can visit us even when we're younger. And so Sun Also Rises takes place after World War One. You've got two main characters are Jake and Lady Brett Ashley, and they are in love, but Jake has suffered an injury in war that has made him sexually impotent. And because of that, they are never able to bind their lives to each other. And Lady Brett is this very promiscuous character. But it's for her, it seems to be an almost an existential promiscuity, by which I mean she's looking for something to anchor her. So if you can think about the young man in A Clean, Well-Lighted Place as finding romance as this anchoring point in life and in the world, I can find meaning here, then what happens in The Sun Also Rises is the collapse of that form of meaning as well. And I think more widely, love and eros go their separate ways in The Sun Also Rises. And I think this signals something probably deeper that Hemingway was getting at, in that with World War One and kind of the collapse of the hopes of European civilization to kind of bring world peace, you have kind of the parting of the old order, if you would, an order which presumably put together eros and love, tried to do that. So the romantic is collapsed, the personal meaning falls apart in the midst of the collapse of a larger world order, a larger philosophical order. So you got that in The Sun Also Rises, but then in Farewell to Arms, you got another attempt to reestablish kind of the interpersonal, to achieve meaning in the interpersonal realm in response to war. And in this one, Fred and Catherine are soldiers, or I think Fred's an ambulance driver as well. That's what his job was. So he was an ambulance driver. Catherine was a nurse. He gets injured. They fall in love. They decide to abandon the war and make their way into a neutral country and try to set up a life there, a romantic life. Again, rejection of the political, the conflicts of the political and all the violence that has led to, and to reestablish just personal meaning. But this endeavor collapses as well, because Catherine dies in childbirth, trying to give birth to her and Fred's son. So he thinks he's escaped this dilemma, the death and carnage all around him, by leaving the battle and escaping into neutral Switzerland and hiding out there and, you know, building this private life. But then again, the rug is pulled out from under him and the life he wanted to build collapses. In fact, I think Catherine's last words to him, it's been a while since I've read this one, are essentially that life is a dirty trick, right? It gets your hopes up, makes you think something can come of it, and then it essentially stomps those or pulls those out from under you. And For Whom the Bell Tolls, I think what's really interesting about that, of course, that the line comes from actually a meditation by John Donne, a religious poet, British poet of the 17th century. And it comes from his meditation on the unity of humanity. He says, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. But in Donne's reading of it, while Europe is going through even then a time of conflict as the Protestant Reformation is underway, and so there is a collapsing, if you would, of a former universal order under European Catholicism, he still roots human unity fundamentally in two things: man's creation by God and then man's participation in the church as a universal body. But those are gone in For Whom the Bell Tolls. And so substituted for them is, in this case, it's the Republic, the leftist side of the Spanish Civil War. And he wants, and so what Hemingway has done is he has, you know, unity is no longer in the religious order. In fact, it is the Catholic Church who is on the opposing side in For Whom the Bell Tolls, and sort of stands for, in Hemingway's estimation, stands for oppression and a kind of inhumane conservatism. But the struggle for a secular polity that is just for all humans becomes the only thing we have left. And so this character comes from America, inserts himself into this struggle, and tries to participate in the establishment of what he hopes will be a new way of life, a new way of being political, a new way of gathered human community. It's troublesome, though, because he has to inflict tremendous violence on other people in order to bring this about, and so the very notion of unity is itself subverted by what they're doing. And then, of course, he dies at the end of it while those he is fighting with do escape. He gives his life so that they can. But this is written after the Civil War, and it's written in a context where everybody knows that the Republic did not last. That the Jordan is the character, so those for whom he fought, this secular polity collapsed as well. So war is, again, it's at the one hand the visitation of death and its ever-present ability to destroy all of our attempts at meaning. And at the same time, it can be, in certain situations, a very troubled attempt to struggle against what seems to be injustice or what seems to be the forces of death themselves. So this is all very, it's very nuanced, very textured, very complex and complicated in Hemingway's work. But it occupied, I think, so much of his years on Earth. There are these vast conflicts that he couldn't help but write them into his novels.
Well, on a lighter note, I want to finally end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Stephen. So, Stephen, we've had a cold winter. Coffee, hot tea, or hot chocolate?
My favorite is tea, hot tea, green tea.
What's one of the websites you visit the most?
Probably The blog Tiny House Talk. I'm kind of intrigued by the tiny house movement, though. As a man with two children, the idea of living in a tiny house with two loud or rambunctious children is downright scary. But aside from that, the notion of tiny houses really fascinates me.
Yeah, that is very interesting, especially if you see like a family of four living in, you know, 600 square feet.
Oh, these are even smaller. They're like 250 square feet. But families of four do it. I couldn't do it. So I look at them, think that's a beautiful idea, but not for me. Not right now anyway with children.
And what's your favorite novel?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I think the best answer to that is probably Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. It's probably my very favorite novel.
Well, that's a heavy work to end with a very serious podcast. So thanks, Stephen, for being on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you, Melanie. It was my pleasure.
Today's guest is Dr. Stephen Mitchell, and he wrote a literary apologetics article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Humanity Crucified, Hemingway and the Human Condition, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. To read more literary apologetics articles, please subscribe to the journal. A subscription is $33.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.